Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Sunday Show on Here Be Monsters. I'm Gwendolyn H. Berry. I'm in South Florida, and I have two guests today coming on. We're going to have some discussion, and mostly from progressive point of view, from left to the center. Sean Crawford, who supports our president strongly, and the progressive changes he proposes, and then Brian Stetton, who's a Democrat and a progressive down here in South Florida, and Brian isn't with us at the moment, so I'll go on with my little introduction here. Here Be Monsters is sponsored by Roundtree 7, that's the number 7.com, bringing knowledge to the social consciousness, and my little company, Daughters of Isis, the Ancestor Aromacology. And we'll give you a moment to wait for, give me a moment to wait for Brian and play a little bit of The Boss. Just one second here while I bring it up. Guys, I hope you can hear me over that wonderful sound transmission at the end of the song there. Sean Prophet and Brian Stetton, you're both on open mics with me right now, and a cordial introduction to Sean to Brian and Brian to Sean, and by way of knowing who you are, I know, Sean, you're a business owner, but would you tell us something about who you are, where you come from?
Well, I live in Los Angeles, and I'm very interested in politics, and I really care a lot about, you know, the future of our country, which I think, you know, I'm very much a supporter of the president, and I'm particularly interested in our energy future. And that's kind of what led me more into politics, because I see how much of our future depends on how we adapt to this energy situation we find ourselves in and the climate. So those are my areas of interest.
Cool. Brian, could you do the same?
Right.
Could you? I know most
yes,
of them
well,
know
I'm,
you.
Yes, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just give us an introduction.
Oh, yeah, I'm Brian Stetton. I live in South Florida. I run the Broward County chapter of Progressive Democrats of America. While I am supportive of some elements within the Democratic Party, I do realize that it has been somewhat corrupted. Because, I mean, essentially, we live in a society that's primarily run by big business. And basic human rights and needs are pretty much trumped for the overwhelming need for key large investors to get profits. So the institutions of democracy we have are pretty much just peripheral at best. But anyway, I also am an active participant with elements of Occupy Fort Lauderdale, especially their anti-capitalist caucus, and also run a blog talk radio show called Progress Toward Democracy. And feel free to join us tomorrow night at 11 o'clock at night on that.
Thanks, Brian. The conversation should be organic. And I, just as Sean is interested in energy and is supportive of President Obama's... I have a question for you, Sean, right off the
sure.
top of my head. About the president's very supportive of putting two new nuclear plants online. And just today, as a matter of fact, and I got this right off the Twitter feed, there's a rally going on in Richland. I don't know if you're aware of it, Brian or Sean. There's a rally going on in Richland. At the nuclear facility in Oregon against nuclear weaponry and power usage. And the speaker is pretty awesome. It's Dr. Helen Caldicott. Do you know that? Do you guys know who I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I know about her.
The attendees are Occupy Portland, and the American Indian Movement is there. AIM is there. Apparently, it's getting a little feisty, too. But I just thought... when we were coming into the show and talking about that, I think that's a great place to start, nuclear energy.
Well, yeah, let me just say that I think that the biggest problem with nuclear energy, aside from any safety issues, is the cost. I mean, nuclear plants cannot operate without government loan guarantees and government insurance. And that should tell you something right there about how expensive and what a bad idea they are. And even if they were cost effective, and even if they weren't dangerous, we still have to solve the waste problem. And I think probably the reason the Native Americans are there is because there's been proposals to put waste on their reservations. And I think that that's shameful that we would be doing that. We can't figure out what to do with it, so we're going to put it on a reservation. You know, so I'm not a supporter of nuclear power for all of those reasons. And I think that whatever the president is doing, he's done a lot of things with energy that I feel he has to do from a political standpoint. He can't be seen as someone who is against energy development. And so he has this sort of all-of-the-above strategy, which, you know, kind of insulates him from criticism from, you know, at least some criticism from the right and from, you know, mainstream voters. So but I'm not saying I agree with him, but I think I understand why he's doing it.
Well, I mean, sadly, unfortunately, it's the nature of our system. The Democratic Party, the liberal institution that we have, primarily supports our system of capitalism, which continues to destroy the middle class, which continues to destroy the environment, which doesn't address the perpetual war machine. And that's very damaging to the party because it causes it to lose credibility. I know lots of environmental activists that consider Obama worse than the Bush administration because he dramatically ramped up domestic production. And we have fracking at an increased level in various states, such as Pennsylvania, where I've heard that there are areas where they have to import their water from the outside. The nuclear energy, it's another example of that. The Exelon Energy, which is heavily involved in the nuclear industry, were big contributors always to Hillary and Bill Clinton, and they obviously swayed Obama to their position. And Obama has talked about clean coal, which has been sort of a joke. There is no such animal. We need a serious push to wind and solar, which Obama supported too. But the fact of the matter is that he is also has to bow to various corporate interests, as does every politician in our system does. And there isn't really a simple way to address this issue. There are movements such as Move to Amend and so forth that are trying to push to get corporate money out of the system. But even that probably will only gain so much traction because we're trying to address a power elite that's not going to bend to our demands. We have to remember that people that are unhappy would like to sit back and vote the rascals out. And the problem is that the rascals were never elected into position in the first place. And I'm referring to those that have the power to influence our politics by essentially making massive campaign contributions and lobbying our politicians on every level.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, it's the money and the Citizens United decision and all these things, corporate personhood, that have corrupted the system to this point. And I don't think there's any way to fix it without fixing those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back early in our history. Actually, it goes well beyond Citizens United. Citizens United is only a distortion that we're seeing now. It's distorting the Republican primaries, and it'll certainly make for an interesting general election. I'm sure we're going to see massive attack ads against Obama. And so I think that leaves who's going to win way up in the air. It'll be who's the more nastier of the two corporate shills. I'm not as overtly a supporter of Obama as you are, but at the other hand, I do see him as the lesser of two evils. It's pretty obvious and evident that by now Mitt Romney is going to be running against him. And when you look at those who contribute money to Mitt Romney, and you really have to look at those who contribute the money because that's who you're voting for. We occasionally have these periods where large investors compete to determine who's going to structure the state. And we mistakenly call those elections and democracy. It's a big mistake.
I'm not sure that it's, I would not necessarily agree that it is as completely. We call them both corporate shills. I think that I have an objection to this idea of this false equivalence between the parties, because I think that the Democrats have always been much more for the common man, common woman, and they have been much more unfriendly to business than the Republicans. And there are clearly exceptions because they have to get elected, and there are lobbyists, who lobby both parties. But I just think that this idea that that they're equally corporate shills, it really hurts, the causes that we're trying to help.
Well, I would say Democrats have to be recognized as to what they are, a sort of safety valve in our society that points to the excesses of capitalism without criticizing capitalism itself. And until we tackle the issue of private ownership of resources and how they're allocated into our society, we're always going to end up with policies that have most of those allocations shift, those resources shifted upward to the top 1%. at this point, the top 0.1% of wealthiest Americans in our country.
So
they're basically tackling the very heart of the fundamental structure of our state-sponsored capitalism. We're always going to be stuck in this, in this trap. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
You don't believe that kind of a social democracy is the answer?
Well, I mean, we're trying to have a social democracy, and it isn't functioning well. We need to make it more democratic, obviously, somehow.
Well, we don't
right
have
now,
democracy.
You know, going into the voting booth and saying, well, perhaps I'll give you another 4 years, just isn't working. It's not engaging people. It's such a large portion of the population has become so disfranchised with the system, they see no difference. They don't bother showing up to vote. It's interesting, by the way, what's happened with TV ratings, with the Republican debates. It's causing people to literally just leave the room with their hands over their head. I think Fox News had a 30% drop in ratings and CNN a 50% drop in ratings because they decided to focus so much attention on the Republican debates. People just do not give a rat. Now, and there's a project that one university was having started called the Vanishing Voter Project. Just where is the voter going? It is not showing up at the polls. More than half of the population doesn't even bother showing up. We're worse than most of our European partners.
I have to say, though, I mean, the cynicism I'm hearing from you actually, I think, contributes to that problem. I think that, you know, when you make it as if, you know, both parties are the same and it doesn't matter and they're all shills and you don't have a democracy anyway, then essentially it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I feel.
We see what happens when we do otherwise. Go ahead.
I have a question. I have a question for Sean. Sean, do you not see it so much as, because I hear what Brian's saying, and he's saying that it's an overall systemic problem, but do you see it more as, because surely you see corruption and fraud in politics and on our side of the street, as it were, the liberal Democrats, just as much now as you can on the other side of the street. But my question is, realistically, are you seeing it as something that's like local corruption that has not corrupted the system? It's just local series of local instances of corruption or corrupt ideal. Where I'm going with this,
well,
right?
Yeah, here's what I think. I mean, certainly politics by definition is corrupt. I mean, because there's a conflict of interest there between, you know, what is good to get elected versus what is good for the country. And that's always going to be a conflict of interest. But I just don't think that the level of corruption that, you know, that we're seeing on the right with, you know, the Koch brothers and, you know, all these super PACs and the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being contributed to these, you know, it just doesn't. There's nothing comparable on the left, none whatsoever. I mean, I don't even care. You can count unions in that. They don't have anywhere near the kind of money or influence that we're talking about. And even Wall Street, you know, they were giving Obama contributions the last election because they thought that he was going to play ball with them. To a certain extent, he did. But you notice they're not giving him the kind of contributions this time that they did before. They're putting their money towards the Republicans. So I just don't. You know, I see the process as being corrupt in general, but I think that there are degrees, and I think that the best we can hope for is to get a lesser degree of corruption.
Yeah, well, I agree with you to a point. I mean, definitely there are levels of slander and lies and so forth from the Republican Party that just reach astonishing levels, you know, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, PolitiFact shows that you know, the average Democratic politician tells one lie for every truth, whereas for the Republicans, they tell two lies for every truth, and most lies are the pants on fire, you know, extreme variety, just completely make stuff up, and, you know, Social Security is a complete Ponzi scheme and so forth, just fantasy. They just make up fantasy. The problem is that by not enacting real change and sort of just trying to satisfy the elite class while addressing, you know, throwing an occasional bone to the public here and there, is that liberals lose more and more credibility. I mean, it goes back to Clinton. Bill Clinton was supposed to bring us universal health care reform, and instead he did welfare reform, total on renewing unemployment and have a congressional battle over that, it's because we destroyed AFDC, which was the main welfare program at the time, you know, because they can't afford to live off $136 a month or something outrageous like that. He got rid of Glass-Steagall. He pushed NAFTA, which just destroyed the middle class, you know, and as well as deregulated further FCC. So we've had this massive consolidation of assets by News Corporation and Clear Channel. So it's all right-wing radio talk now. 8 out of 10 radio shows are, no, it's worse than that.
It's worse than that.
And he did so much damage that he lost the traditional Democratic voter, which was labor. I mean, most of the working class been listening to Rush Limbaugh for years. I mean, just totally lost credibility. And the big concern is that not just losing credibility for the liberal institutions, and they demonize the word liberal so bad, by the way, that when you do polls, the average American would rather call himself a fiscal conservative than a liberal, because liberal is being turned into a curse word. What's interesting,
right,
though, if you poll the average American on the underlying issues, the average person is far, far left. You ask them honestly, would you like, say, Medicare for everybody? They overwhelmingly want it. You know, so the average American's far left. But, I mean, they've just distorted the language so much that actual liberal values have lost credibility. Basic liberal values, for example, like how political correctness pushes back against bigotry, that's lost credibility. You've noticed the very moral fiber of our society going downhill. I've never seen such a rampant racism, embracing of Islamophobia. It just goes on and on. You see our culture literally being debased.
Go ahead, Sean.
The thing is, there's about 20 subjects that you just brought up, and you know, I don't know how to quite address. You know, it seems to me. Let's go back to Clinton and what he did.
Sorry about it. I tend to take a big picture point of view.
Yeah, that's, I hear you. I'm just trying to, you know, because I think that, I mean, Clinton was elected in 2 terms, and I think that he, all of those things that you talked about, you know, should be taken separately. Certainly, Glass-Steagall was a big problem. Media deregulation was a big problem. Welfare reform should have been handled differently. But when I think about Clinton, and, you know, there's no question in my mind that he absolutely wanted that health care reform. And it was not, you know, he was not able to pull it off. And you see the opposition that Obama had to face to do the same thing. And I just think that to try to blame Clinton for not getting health care passed, that's something that happens a lot, I feel, is that Democrats or liberals blame their own people for the opposition of the other party, and you know.
I have to look at it as a bigger picture, as what the candidate eventually actually ends up doing and what he ends up signing off of. We have to look at what they actually do and what they're still doing. It was only a couple years ago, more than that, about 4 years ago, before the 2008. Can't remember how many years, but Bill Clinton wrote an article basically patting himself on the back on how successful welfare reform was. And we can look now at the masses and see that's far from the case. As more and more people fall into poverty, and well over a quarter of the population is dependent on food subsidy, food stamps.
Well, I think...
You know, I mean, so I think they're kind of out... I think they're more out of touch than you think. You know,
you're saying, though, is that it was unsuccessful, and it depends on how you define success. I mean, I'm not sure that I agree that the American public is as far to the left as you think they are. I think we're actually more of a center-right country, and I think the reason why the word liberal has been demonized is because...
No, that's false. I think that's very false. Center-right, yeah, if you go by just the words, because, I mean... The word liberal, we've had 30 years of propaganda basically demonizing the word. So, of course, you know, when you poll the population, one can say, ha-ha, see the population center-right. But when you poll the people on the underlying issues, you know, once again, they vastly want universal health care. They are, you know, overwhelmingly against the wars. They are, you know, if you ask them a question, do you want to balance the budget? I mean, it's very, it depends on how you ask it. You ask a person, you know, well, would you like your mortgage to be paid off in 5 years? And you just leave it at that. You know, a person will say, sure. Would you like to pay off your mortgage in 5 years, but you know, you'll have to starve your kids and live off ramen noodle soup every night and so forth? That person's
yeah.
more than likely going to say no. So when you ask them, you know, would you like to balance the budget, but we'll have to cut Social Security, we'll have to cut Medicare, we'll have to, you know, all of a sudden
right.
the popularity of that question on balancing the budget goes from 85% to 25%.
Which
no, agree.
You know, so,
agree.
You know, so
it's
just... You know, so, yeah, I mean, the population actually is far left of the government, and it's, you know, the center-right is a false. You know.
Well, it brings up the idea, too. It brings up the reality of austerity, which the president has actually been, you know, taking austerity measures with certain
mm-hmm.
bills lately. Austerity is going on all throughout Western society right now. Are you, Brian, and are you, Sean, up on what's going on over in Western Europe with the austerity
right.
measures in
yes.
in Italy and Greece and Ireland?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I bring those up because there was an article this weekend in the New York Times on the suicide rate going on, and
right.
I think everybody saw the article on the 77-year-old Greek who lost
yes.
everything and committed suicide in the square there
yes.
in Athens.
Well, one of the things you have to think about is that, you know, these austerity measures that are being put in place are actually being used by the right in this country as an example of how Europe has failed and how entitlements have failed, and I think, you know, it's a really dishonest tactic on their part. I mean, they've always hated the social democracies of Europe, and they've always, you know, hated, because one of the things, if you look at what happens when you have social democracy and a strong safety net, religiosity decreases, and the society becomes more secular. And so, you know, it's this whole blending of the religious right with politics that we've had since Reagan, and, you know, they know that once we have a social safety net in place, the whole religious right is going to go away. And
yeah, the
so
control factor goes away. I agree with you, Sean.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's been documented that, you know, as soon as you have a safety net, as soon as people aren't scared, hungry, and, you know, sick, then they become much less religious. And that's something that I think that it doesn't get enough attention here is how much the religious right, aside from the culture war issues, cannot stand the idea of having people, you know, self-reliant and you know, and having a relationship with the government.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But, you know, no economist seriously believes that you grow an economy by cutting off people's jobs or cutting down their pay. You know, I mean, obviously then they contribute less to the economy and the economy shrinks to size. I mean, austerity programs are effectively social programs themselves. I mean, one of the things, I mean, for example, I mean, during the years where we had Alan Greenspan knew very well that to satisfy the elite, to keep in place what he always called a flexible labor force, meaning have always enough people that are unemployed so that people can't demand higher wages and higher pay at their jobs. You don't have a shortage of labor. You always have a surplus of labor, and it keeps people's wages down. And that enhances the profits of companies. So in that sense, austerity, you know, so in that sense, austerities are a social program. You, in other words, you make the population poorer, and therefore you'll always have a very flexible labor force. Social program.
Okay.
But they're social
sorry.
Programs
have,
for the elite, not
to that.
For the people.
I have to,
go ahead.
Well, I have to respond to that because the thing about Greenspan is that, you know, it's recognized that if you have unemployment under 5%, it actually is somewhat dangerous for the economy because then there's nobody there to do the jobs. You know, if there's nobody there to hire. You know, so you can't grow. You know, if you have unemployment is too low. So I think that it was really right around 4 to 5%, which was almost a record low under Greenspan. I'm not saying that his policies were good otherwise. I mean, the low interest rates inflated the housing market and led directly to, you know, the bubble. So I don't know, but I just I'm not sure that we could have much lower unemployment than 4 or 5%.
Yeah, but I mean, they do want a flexible labor force, keep the wages low, so that we can compete with other nations and so forth. They continually push wages in the state of Florida. Now there's a push to lower the minimum wage for those that work in the restaurant industry and so forth. If you live off of tips, they want to knock the minimum wage down to $2. That's not going to help anybody. It goes back to my original premise. Like, profits overwhelmingly trump, needs of the people.
I have a question.
That's the way our system is run. That has to change.
How do you strike a balance between the need for profitable business, which is important, and the needs of society? That's my question, because I hear a lot of this rhetoric about how profits are evil, but I think that there's got to be a way to balance it, and I'm wondering what you think that is.
I don't think it's a matter of balance. Once again, we have large corporations that are way too monopolistic. Why are we catering to their needs? I'm not talking about the small business. If anything, the system is very negative towards small business. Go ahead.
Could you define small business for me? Now, I know that Sean is a businessman. He owns his own business. I own my own business. I'm very small. I'm a mom and pop. I'm a maker. I make my own product. And I do a very, very small, what I call small business, but what the government calls small business grosses $500 to $1 million a year. And that's not me. And that's not the majority of what politicians like to refer to as the small business person they're catering to. They're referring to me, but they're catering actually to, a much larger corporate structure. So somebody, my point here is asking both of you from your points of view about the...
I would say when the revenue of a business becomes comparable to the gross domestic product of a nation, then it's ceased to become small. Exxon Mobil has a gross revenue of around $435 billion, and that's a size of the GDP of Sweden, or the GDP of it's bigger than the GDP of Pakistan, or the GDP of hundreds of other nations. Now, who has more impact on, say, the Kyoto Protocol? One of those nations, which is trying to please a whole bunch of people, and supposedly more of a democracy, or a business where most of the decision making is a CEO, board of directors, and perhaps a couple of hedge fund managers that have a major impact on the price of their stock. Let's take Walmart, where I forget the exact number, but the number of people that work for Walmart, and again, it's several hundred nations have populations that are smaller than the number of employees that work for Walmart. Or the number of employees that work for McDonald's. Yeah. These are no longer small businesses. The impact they have on our government is tremendous. It's very, very distorting. I mean, we're talking 0.1% of the population, that has tremendous influence on our government.
It's how a company behaves. It's not how big they are. I don't think it matters at all how big a company is, except for in the sense of lobbying and their ability to purchase, elections and all that. That's what that gives you. But, you can have a benign large corporation, and you can have a really nasty, evil small business and corrupt small business.
Disagree with that. I mean, first of all, all corporate entities, throwing small businesses into the mix blurs things, because, a nasty small businessman, on the microeconomic level, you really do have freer markets. And so his employees may get fed up with him in a walk and so forth. I mean, it's a little different than a large corporation.
What I'm hearing Sean say is, And I thought he said it very well. It's not about how much money these corporations, these large corporations make. It's about how they behave. And I understand what he's saying, and to a degree, I am in accord with him because, I mean, I'm a Kodak kid out of Rochester, New York, and I know plenty of people who have done through the benefits, their education or what have you, through the benevolence of good corporate behavior, if you follow where I'm going there. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that. A good corporate behavior model is mine, not ExxonMobil.
Let's take a well-known brand name. I mean, do you consider Coca-Cola a good company, a good corporate behavior
model?
There's a couple of things with Coca-Cola. Okay, they produce a lot of plastic bottles, which are just basically strewn all over the environment. Their main product is sugar, which has tremendous externalities in terms of diabetes and other problems that people have. Coca-Cola is not a good company. And the way that you could cause Coca-Cola to become a good company would be to begin to regulate some of those things, to begin to tax the plastic bottles, to begin to, to put a tax on sugar, just like we have a tax on cigarettes and alcohol. These companies, the only reason they're able to get away with this stuff is because there is not regulation on their behavior.
Well, I mean, it's a lot of bad behaviors there, and Coca-Cola is also has been caught hiring right-wing militia types in Colombia to kill off labor leaders that demand higher wages for their workers in bottling plants in the country of Colombia.
Well,
got caught with
there
that.
You go.
Hiring Greek riot police to literally crack the skulls of protesters that were doing a sit-in,
Isn't the solution to that, though, to bring them to justice over those things?
Yes.
Well, we try,
there's two sets of rules.
There's a set of rules for us, and there's a set of rules for the elite. If you're a poor black kid and you get caught selling in small quantities of pot, you're wrecked for life. If you're a kid that works, that's with a rich family, President Bush was a great example of that. He should have had no career, but Daddy Warbucks is able to bail out the kid over and give him multiple chances. The elite class have a different set of rules. And that goes for corporations, too. And besides, corporations are structured by Anglo-Saxon law to go after profit, not the service.
No, I understand that, but I don't understand, why that surprises anyone. I mean, you have the corporation is operating properly. It's doing what it's supposed to do. And it is the role of government to regulate and to act as a check and balance on that. Because right now, the corporations are no check or balance. And so that's the whole point of social democracy, is to have corporations do what they do and to have the government regulate it. And that's, the problem is if you start with this, it's a fatalistic attitude, I think, to say that, there's just two sets of rules. It's like, well, we should change that,
I think we've tried. And I think the institutional liberal class tries to periodically, and it always gets undermined. Either the courts get bought, the agencies themselves get bought, the politicians get bought. It's very hard to push back against it because of the very structure of our system itself.
I don't hear any hope, sir. I hear complete fatalism in what you're saying.
No, not at all. I think that we need to start deconstructing certain types of institutions in our society. I mean, all institutions were built by man. And introduce new ones, perhaps, and see how that works out. But, expecting the current electoral process to make bold changes is, probably end up being defeatist because it usually disappoints people in the past. It certainly disillusioned a lot of people that voted for Obama. And that's why you had all of a sudden this wave of Republicans hop into office in 2010. And not a Democrat came out to vote.
But those were not disillusioned Obama supporters who put those Republicans in. That was an energized, bought and paid for American Crossroads, GPS, Koch Brothers, Tea Party you know,
AstroTurf.
What happened in 2010. You know, it wasn't disillusioned.
Well, the Tea Party, yeah, but the Tea Parties beat the Obama supporters by, you know, getting 15% more of the vote. It was nothing. I mean, the fact of the matter is a lot of Obama supporters did not come out to vote at all.
Well,
you know,
and then
everybody
will they come out now? Will there be? I mean, you can listen to MSNBC or CNN tell you that President Obama has an 85% positive polling with registered Democrats and liberals, but that's not what you hear when you go to the, you know, different liberal meeting down on the corner or the Occupy meeting,
yeah,
who are all Democratic voters. I can guarantee you that.
On Occupy, you have your fair share of the Ron Paul fanatics, and they're so out of touch. It's
independence, yes.
Right.
But the independents voted
Brian,
for
I'm glad we agree about Ron Paul.
Yeah, no, I could go. I hate the guy, too.
Yeah, we're all there.
But as far as Occupy is concerned, or the Democratic left, I mean, if they don't come out for Obama, they might as well just put a gun to their head. You know, it's just like
I definitely am a believer that if you're in a swing state, you should vote for Obama. You know, but I don't know if the voters are going to do it or not. And right now, Obama does have a lead because of the so-called publicized war on women, and Mitt Romney and the Republican Party deserve it. But whether it's going to maintain that, I don't know. We have yet to see how much money is going to be thrown into attack ads. And the way that Romney's defeated his competitors is by, you know, carpet bombing, that Newt Gingrich called it.
But Obama actually
he has a point. I kind of got a kick out of that campaign, by the way. I got a kick out of the way Newt Gingrich made an anti-capitalist film to bash Mitt Romney when Mitt Comes to Town or something like that.
And it was true, the stuff that he put into it. But, Sean, you had a point you were trying to make. What was that?
Well, I'm not sure which one, but I just think that, the left is going to have to come out for Obama. And, you know, if they don't, you know, I think he has the bully pulpit, and that's what is going to, I think, win the day over all this corporate money, because – in the end,
I disagree. Yeah, I don't expect it to change the fundamental structure of our society. I really don't. That's going to disappoint a lot of people if we do. And, you know, my only concern is, you know, I mean, I'm not so far on the left that I say I'm elevated above it all and see no difference at all between the two. I mean, yeah, I definitely see a little bit of difference between the Republican Party and the Democrats, that the Republicans will hurt more people. More people will suffer under them. And so I think one should vote appropriately to prevent more people from getting harmed. But I mean, definitely,
Go
ahead, I'm sorry.
I was saying, basically, you know, Obama has the bully pulpit, and one of the things that we're seeing is, you know, he's starting to talk about the budget, and his speech that he made to the Associated Press a week or two ago was all about the budget, and that budget is so important to Americans. And when people start understanding the choice between giving millionaires another $150,000 tax cut versus, you know, a veterans care, education benefits, you know, sending your kids to college and things like that, I just don't think there's any contest. And he just needs to keep hammering that message, you know, that budget and the right wing, attacks on the middle class, you know, are something that he's actually, you know, he's doing a good job defending against that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, more of that would be better. I mean, I wish it was more like, France, where there's a left front presidential candidate there that's starting to gain enormous popularity, and he's pushing for 100% taxation on any amount made over half a million for the year. You wouldn't see that coming here. I mean, what Obama is suggesting is incredibly tame.
The left is all devastated in our country anyway. You know, like, basically you have, you know, like, when somebody says, like, 100% taxation, they're going to get thrown out. Nobody is going to vote for that. You know, it just sounds ridiculous. And so, you know, that's where you start to get into this, like, the rhetoric is so extreme to the left that, I don't even think that's what we would want. I think it would kill the economy if you did something like that.
for people making over half a million? I mean, I'm not going to get into supporting his policy. We're not France. It's sort of silly. France has a totally different dynamic. I mean, France wouldn't, the students in France wouldn't let what's happening here to our colleges, and our colleges are being decimated. I mean, it's horrible what's happening here.
Yes, they
are.
It's
really
awful.
Tragic. What's going on here, and it just gets worse and worse, you know. And if that happened in France, the students would completely shut down the country, you know. So we're not
right.
France.
Well, we don't even need to do that. All we need to do is you know, get rid of the Bush tax cuts and, you know, enact, you know, some form of the Buffett rule and those types of things. Reasonable solutions, you know, where you're not asking them to pay 100% or even 50%, but you're asking them to pay at least 30%. I mean, you know. I think that's something that, you know,
with the charitable donation loophole. That's what the Buffett package has.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another compromise, and that's being portrayed as socialism. It's a joke. Now we need to go further to the left than that.
But you know about the
you know, but I mean, I agree. It's better than nothing, and it has a popular ring to it. But, you know, once again, if you poll the population, 85% of the population believes we should tax the rich. The people that make over $1 million definitely should pay their fair share. This goes across party lines. You know, once again, showing
right.
that the people are far left of the government, and what the mainstream media is touting is, you know, is this complete crap, nonsense.
But you know that.
You know, I mean, the average person doesn't believe that the super rich are job creators. They don't buy it.
Right. Right. Well, they've done this whole thing with the Overton window, where essentially the Republican Party has, and this is a strategy that was, you know, that they've done with focus groups and everything else like that, and figured out that they have been espousing these extreme positions to make their former positions seem, you know, reasonable. And so, you know, every part of their strategy, from the birth control to the, you know, all of that is all part of this trying to shift the whole Overton window.
Yeah,
to the right.
But the thing is that Obama's passing the former reasonable. That's the problem. Like, our health care reform act was a Republican policy. You know, that's why Mitt Romney had to backtrack on all of it and say, oh, well, it works for Massachusetts, but doesn't work for anywhere else. It's a Republican
right.
policy developed by the Heritage Foundation, which is a god-awful right-wing think tank. And frankly, I don't care for the concept of the mandate at all.
We should be
pushing for single payer, but it's, you know.
Right, and I think that, you know, the mandate was only there as a stopgap because he couldn't get single payer.
We had the private insurance sector essentially bought both parties. One party
right.
pushed, one party was basically pushing a massive bailout to the insurance sector, and the other party, the Republicans, were pushing status quo with a few added benefits, such as allowing insurance companies to merge across state lines, therefore letting them get even more powerful. I mean, so it was a win-win either way. It was a win-win either way for the private insurance sector. Anybody that was pushing for single payer was just kept out of the dialogue altogether.
And this just goes back to what we were saying before about essentially, you know, until you get the money out of politics, none of this stuff is going to change. Like,
But I mean, this is not a Citizens United issue. This is well before that.
Well, this is lobbying.
So, I mean, you know, it's a fact of who owns our country. You know, this goes back
I'm just not sure that sort of language is descriptive, okay, because owns our country. I mean, there is a specific process by which these companies influence, and that's what we have to go after. By saying they own our country, it's essentially, again, makes it like there's no solution. And we should be talking about lobbying. We should be talking about specific laws that need to be changed. And, you know, to me, because when you start saying that, you know, these companies own our country, they really don't. You know, the people, the voters own the country.
I have to go back to what some of our founding fathers said, like John Jay, who made the statement that those that own the country ought to govern, or Madison, who was the principal architect of our Constitution. that stated that the main role of government should be to protect the opulent minority, meaning the rich, from the vast majority. By giving more rights to those that own property, we essentially started a class warfare right at the get-go. You know, and it's been that way ever since.
You know, absolutely. I'm not in favor, believe me, I'm not in favor of any of that double standard, but I just think I hear a lot of this, you know, it's not really, I think if we look at the specific things that can be changed, you know, everything from limiting CEO compensation to, you know, limiting lobbying and, you know, putting some teeth in it, campaign finance reform, repeal citizens united, you know, talk about these very specific things.
You're talking about solutions, Sean, that you see available. The problem I keep seeing with all of those available solutions is that they keep getting bought out and co-opted by politicians on one side or the other who are bought by the opposers, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And I think you're right, Sean. I do think that you're right to look for the solutions within the framework that we have. I think you're right to do that. But the framework that we have is being written away. Do I have to say NDAA? There's no habeas corpus right now in this country. And when I go down to the square next Saturday to stand with the rest of the occupiers, if the police and Homeland Security don't like the way I look or what I'm saying, the possibility exists that they can snatch my ass off the street, stick me in the can, and y'all got to look for me for a while. You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to make light of it, but it's the truth.
Well, let me be devil's advocate to that, Gwen, because to be fair, the accusations of a police state, the problem with the accusation of a police state is that if you're in certain minorities, like a black and Latino, it's been a police state for a very long time. We basically criminalized being a black youth a long time ago, so this isn't something new. It's not something new. I mean, our prison population, we have 1 out of 100 Americans in prison, more than any other country on the earth. No other country does that to, you know, a percentage of their population. Over half of those people are black. And then, actually, I'm wrong. Criminalizing the black youth, because the word criminal assumes that they have constitutional rights. I mean, for example, in cities like New York City, they have search and seizure laws. Like 72% of the black youth just get pulled off the streets every day, searched at random for drugs, just pulled off in the jail into a prison industrial complex that's focused on driving profit. And really the main purpose of it is to help control the overall population, especially that which is considered to be the superfluous population. So we've been in a police state for a long time. It's just that white middle-class students participating in Occupy are now finally learning that the purpose of the police is to protect property and not them.
Yeah, it's been about 60 years since they've recognized that.
Yeah.
So I mean, I understand. I mean, but I do think that during the 60s, there were all kinds of protests and all kinds of white people being dragged off and arrested. And so, you know, the idea of civil disobedience is that you are trying to get arrested to make a point. And I think that for people to expect that the powers that be are going to allow them to just get away with, you know, these civil disobedience and then not be arrested, you know, I think that's a bit naive.
I think civil disobedience is the only true democracy. Or the only true democratic action we have left, really.
Considering the system is rigged.
Right. Well, don't expect though that if you do participate in civil disobedience, that you're not going to be arrested and treated harshly, because that's what the state does.
We as a people have to realize that the state can be very wrong, as they have been. And they have to start being accountable for their actions as they
there
they should
you
be.
Go. Accountability. Where is the accountability?
Right. I mean, a great example is what's going on with the banks. So Obama punished the banks with a $25 billion fine for robo-signing, which hasn't changed. It's still going on. That's having people fraudulently sign off on mortgage documents. You know, if you or I committed fraud like that, we go to jail. How many people went to jail in the banking sector?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that they should have, you know, in return for all that money that the U.S. Treasury put up for the banks, that we should have basically nationalized them. That's what I think.
Oh, I agree. I agree. But that's extreme left.
Yeah.
That's extremely left-wing talk there, you're saying, Sean.
Well,
I agree.
Here's the thing. It wasn't for no reason. It's not like we just said, okay, one day we're going to come in and take over the banks. It's that we said, okay, we put up $700 billion and actually more like $9 trillion or whatever it is, you know, in the total final analysis of taxpayer funds. It's like we basically bought them. We didn't have to let them continue to own themselves. Yeah.
Well, it would have been cheaper to buy the bank. The cost to nationalize the banks would have been 10 to 20% of the cost to bail them out. It would have been far cheaper. And then we could have ramped up providing loans to needy business owners, especially small business, right off the bat. Instead, the big banks didn't do that because they didn't want to take the market risk, and they're focused on trading instruments. And actually, if anything else, they helped wreck Europe. You know, the president of the prime minister of Italy is a former Goldman Sachs employee. I mean, that's not a coincidence. You know, prime minister of Greece is from the financial services sector too.
The same money that went to those banks could have easily gone to homeowners and paid off the mortgages. It would have saved the banks and it would have saved everybody's homes. You have no foreclosure crisis. It would have really been a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Same money.
Well, there goes the quandary. See, that's the situation we're stuck in, how resources are allocated in our society. And the resources are allocated to the top 1%, and they're not allocated to everybody else. It's not fair. And you have a group of people that realized it, Occupy. Unfortunately, they're very divided, so it's hard to say which way that movement's going to go. But that movement did at least make a very clear recognition of class denomination, the 1% versus the 99%. And we saw what happened with that. You know, I mean, you scream that your class that we have we're a class dominated society. In a class dominated society, you get shut down.
Right.
They also called out the hypocrisy in the Democratic Party, and that's one of the reasons why the Obama administration played a role in helping shut Occupy down. Yeah,
this is as good as any a moment to also remind everybody, since I'm not going to play the what do you call it today, that May Day, May 1st, is a day of general strike, and Herbie Monsters supports the general strike, and of course, we're part of the Occupy community here. Just saying, gentlemen, wanted to get that in there. Thank you.
No, I think that's good. But you don't play the what, Gwen? I'm sorry. I was kind of curious what you meant by that.
Oh, my little non-May Day general strike tape. It's a little lengthy, and we're at the
running out of
very
time.
Top of the hour. I'm just wanting to get that May Day general strike in there. And Sean, do you have a final point to make?
Well, I think that, a lot of what we're hearing from, you know, people who are, I think it's good to take the Democratic Party to task. You know, I think it's good to have that internal conversation. But when it comes time to vote, whether it's for president or whether it's for, you know, senator or congressman, it's time for the Democrats to turn out and vote Democratic because, you know, whatever happens is going to be far better. And it's going to lead us to far more progressive policies than voting for any Republican.
I hear you, Sean.
Well,
Brian,
I agree. I don't want to throw a vote to a fascist movement like the Republicans. You know, but I think, unfortunately, I think the problem is that the system is corrupt to the core. And until people actually begin to challenge and protest against the very nature of capitalism itself, we're kind of stuck in a trap. We're stuck in kind of a two-party dictatorship that won't let anything else enter. We need radical changes in our voting system, perhaps something like instant runoff voting, perhaps ridding of the Electoral College and depending on popular vote. to perhaps going exclusively to public financing and making it easier for smaller parties to get on the ballot. But we definitely need more democracy in our society, and to insist otherwise, you know, I think is foolhardy at this point.
I really want to thank both of you for coming on today and presenting sort of you're both progressive gentlemen, but you have different points and opposing points of view that need to be listened to and need to be heard and put out there. I thank you very much for coming on with me and doing so. Please don't forget that you can hear Brian Stetton over at Progress Towards Democracy. I know it's Thursday at 11 p.m. When else is it, Brian?
Tomorrow night, Monday night at 11 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
Also Fridays at 7. Yeah. So.
Okay. And I want to really thank you, Sean, Sean Prophet, for coming on and speaking his mind. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Sean. And thank you for having me on again, Glenn.
Oh,
great
hey,
to talk to you,
Brian.
Guys.
Well, it's a real pleasure, Sean. Hopefully I can get you to be even further to the left.
It's going to be a fast pull there, guys.
You know, consider looking at the works of literature out there on anarcho-syndicalism and so forth. Anyway, have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Everybody, and I want to thank everybody for listening in. We didn't get our promo from Anita Stewart calling in for tomorrow's Wise Woman show, but please look for her online in the social networks and on Twitter and on the Here Be Monsters show page. Also, I would like to remind everybody that tomorrow begins the ceremony in Mandeville that will end up in Louisiana, what we've been promoting for a week with Ms. Amani and Dr. John and the 13 Grandmothers Council, Soul Fire for the Gulf. Please, folks, send your good vibes, send your prayers, if that's what you do. Whatever you can send to Louisiana and to the Gulf by ways of healing, please do so. This has been Sunday with Here Be Monsters. Thank you for listening. And as always, thanks to Brian Stetton and thanks to Sean Prophet for coming on and speaking with us and making his point of view known. That's it, fellas.